I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Philly Pride is this weekend with activities at Penn's Landing Great Plaza marking the event's 30th anniversary. The first parade and festival was back in 1988. Comedian Margaret Cho is the headliner. Last week, the mayor's office held a first-ever LGBTQ State of the Union, which Mayor Jim Kinney called a historic event. Joining us is Evan Thornburg, Deputy Director of the City's Office of LGBT Affairs, to talk about some of Philadelphia's initiatives and challenges. Evan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So how welcoming would you say Philadelphia is to LGBTQ individuals?
I would say, I mean, every city has its challenges, so I'm not going to say that there's nothing. There's imperfections, of course. But I think this city is an amazingly progressive and kind of like I think it's a sleeper. I think a lot of people think of other major cities when they start to think of LGBTQ rights. But Philadelphia is really a pioneer, especially on the East Coast, when it comes to legislation and representation.
Pride is 30 years old. You were 2 years old when it began, just to tell our audience here. But what does this month mean to you?
This month means so many things. First of all, I love this month mainly because I love that of a protest, we've decided as a community that we're going to celebrate, you know, and that we're going to just like blow out the edges of it and say like, okay, you won't reckon with us, you know, 50 years ago, and now you're going to reckon with us all month. I love it's born of a protest, and so it's an announcement that we're here and we're going to continue to exist, and that's amazing.
You grew up in Philadelphia. Interesting family, you were telling me before going on the air. Tell us, our listeners.
So I grew up with two dads. Primarily, so my dad and my mom were married. My dad is white, my mom is black. They met in Atlanta, Georgia, about 20 years after the Loving case. And so there's a lot of interesting things there. They had to have race on their marriage license.
Really?
Yeah, it was very strange. My dad had to, like, there was a lot with that. And then subsequently they had me and my sister. And then later on, my dad came out as gay, and they had been best friends before. And my mom was like, I kind of knew that. I understand. I just want to be your best friend. They're still best friends to this day. And when I was about 11 years old, my dad met my other dad, and they subsequently raised me up until what we see today. So,
did you feel like you grew up in a gay family? I mean, did you think of it that way?
As a kid, you don't think that your family's gay. You know, you recognize that other people have a different structure in their home. But when you go home and it's full of love, like, you kind of, I mean, really the way I experienced it was that, like, everybody else was, like, so strange for, like, having opinions about my household being so loving. It's also like really endearing as a woman of color, particularly a black woman, to be able to say I had this very supportive white men who encouraged me to be all of myself. They were very intersectional. They challenged a lot of things around racism, and had these really, like, very staunch conversations with me. And I think their gayness helped them move forward in that thought process, especially. I don't think it does that for everybody, but I think for them and then having me, they really had to have these conversations.
Did you feel safe?
Yeah, absolutely. I had an amazing, I was doted on. I will absolutely tell you, I'm a spoiled child.
Well, good for you.
In the best way possible. I don't think I was a brat, but.
Right. Never too much love in this world, right?
No, exactly. And just, I could just be myself. Like, there was never a question of, like, who was I, and it wasn't okay. Like, there was always like, okay, like, Evan's doing that. That's cool.
Let me just give out the phone number, and it's 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. I mentioned the State of the Union that was held by the mayor's office last week. What was the outcome, I guess, of all that? What was the takeaway from that?
The takeaway from the community members that I've spoken to thus far was that they actually didn't know the breadth of work that a lot of the organizations were doing, and they didn't know the breadth of work that these organizations could do on the budgets that some of them had. I think that's been incredibly amazing that some of our smaller organizations, really on like a shoestring budget sometimes, can support so many programs and so many people. It's just a it's a testament to like the ingenuity of this community to like reach out and connect and collaborate and just say like, I'm not going to leave you behind. I'm just going to figure it out. I'm going to figure out how you can come too. They just constantly making space on the boat. You know, it's really amazing. So I think a lot of people took away that. A lot of people really, it was like a lot of people treated it as a networking event. So I heard a lot of people walk away who have small businesses or who are trying to get more involved, who said, like, oh, I got phone numbers, you know, I got people's names, I'm going to make connections, I'm really excited to, like, actually be present, especially in this day and age. Like, I want to be present. I don't want to just kind of watch from the outside and kind of, like, casually engage every once in a while. I want to be, like, consistently there.
Has this issue that came up, a year or so ago about some racist incidents in the quote-unquote gayborhood, has that been addressed? It's a big issue. Yeah. I realize
racism is always a big issue, and the question, yes, like, is it ever addressed? but I think our office is doing a great job of addressing it. So I will say that the leadership, Amber Hikes' leadership, has been really stellar and really.
She heads up your office. Yeah,
she does. She's the executive director, and I think she's been really excellent at thinking about how we can, you know, roll these things into constantly everything we do. Both of us are very much like attached to intersectionality, thinking about who's still marginalized within this community, like who needs to be part and parcel of it. And racism was such a big deal. I mean, we had a report on it, immense amounts of racism in this city or in this, the gayborhood specifically, 30 years ago, back in the 80s, there was a report put out. So it's
interesting.
So it's, you know, it hasn't been directly addressed. And I think for myself, I would say I'm very attached to directly addressing it. And Amber has been really great at creating transparency and putting community in conversation to directly address it.
I know your office has been working on training city employees about a whole host of LGBTQ issues, and a lot of them looking like it has to do with language, about how we use language in conversing with each other.
Yeah. Language is one of those things. I always like to believe that language is where violence starts, right? Because when we categorize things or when we use the wrong language for something, it's the start of deciding what that thing or who that person is. When I decide what your name is, that's already a step into, I think, a certain amount of oppression. Mm. And so it's really important for me to have folks in the city. By and large, the city workers are amazing. So I will definitely shout out the city and say I have not been to a training yet where I had people who were like really abusive or really resistant. Everybody seemed really open and really responsive. And they were just really excited to learn the right language because they recognize that they just don't have it. So that's where we start, and then we build into some of the challenges in the community, some of the things that they may see in the demographics or the work that they do. I try to make it relatable to the departments that I address or to the departments that I engage in.
I think we did a show recently that touched on this, and I, even on the air, I was fumbling over myself trying to make sure to use the right pronouns. So I think it is a matter of, in a sense, learning a new language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, with any cultural group or any community, I think it absolutely is. And I think it's very important. I'm going to definitely give a shout out to the Upper Euclid Police Department here. I went up there and they were telling me how they were doing all this cultural competency training constantly. They're one of the few accredited police departments in the state. I think there's only four. And they're one of them. And the accreditation process is like 172 points. So they're amazing. Wow. And they brought me out to get the right language, but they had recognized that they needed the right language because they had also done training around specifically, I think, Indian culture. And so they had folks come out and teach them about behavior and cultural mannerisms and like intonation and like how they should ask questions because there's a different culture and community that they're engaging with.
I know your agency is also looking at the needs of elderly people, also DHS looking for foster care families that have some of these sensitivities. Help us understand that.
So one of the things that we're trying to really look at for elders is around long-term care spaces. We have the largest amount of HIV-positive elders who are moving into care right now than ever before.
You know?
I don't know the exact number. I know it's larger. It's the largest group because you have the group that originally was at kind of the ground zero experience of the AIDS and HIV epidemic in the 80s, aging into senior care. And it's really important that those spaces are prepared and ready, not just in terms of their like healthcare, but also like their policies. We don't want our elders going back into.
A little button got pushed there. Go ahead. Not you. That was us.
We don't want our elders going back into the closet simply to have a safe place to live. And we also want them to have a certain amount of agency over their own existence and their own identities. And with DHS, we're trying to do a better job, and we're working in tandem with DHS on making, again, them competent on the language and also how they can reach out and promote LGBTQ inclusion, LGBTQ competent families or allies or LGBTQ specific families to join DHS in the foster care system, because historically we've been turned away. And so there's now kind of an understanding that that's not a place for us. So even though we would love to be parents, we would love to foster and we would love to participate, we've been taught, for me, even from my home, is like, that's not, you're going to be turned away. Don't waste your time. Don't fill out the paperwork.
Oh, wow.
And so we're trying to do a better, we're thinking about a campaign or an advertising campaign, and as well as this training that makes it comprehensive for them and their KUAs.
There was this campaign started a while ago, It Gets Better. Is that still important? I mean, speaking to youth who might be feeling ostracized or uncomfortable or in some degree of stress?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Young people, I think it's more important now than ever, because that campaign started, from what I remember, during the Obama administration.
True.
And I think that it was believable then. And I think we need to really kind of double down on that now with the kind of federal leadership that we have nationally. I mean, it's no secret that that's very much a huge concern for this population, and our young people are the biggest concern. Young people are at the mercy of adults, and if the adults, particularly the adults that are leading the nation, are either at best neglecting them and at worst targeting them, then, yeah, we need to constantly, as a community, like, sing louder than that. And that has to be that it's going to get better, or we're going to make it better. Maybe that's the change of the slogan. We're going to make it better. Like, not that we just are going to assume it will get better.
Almost out of time here. So what are you going to be doing this weekend?
Well, there's the Dyke March tomorrow, which is Philadelphia's infamous. I did use that word. That's what it's called. And then there's Pride. I mean, I love seeing the parade. So I also love seeing our young people march in the parade. And I think our elders are being honored as grand marshals. And I'm so excited to see that. So those are kind of the things I'll be doing, and mainly hanging out with my wife and taking a little bit of time to myself.
Evan Thornburg, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Deputy Director of the City's Office of LGBT Affairs, talking about Philly Pride this weekend. We're going to take a very short break. Then we'll be talking about a cake, a baker, and a gay couple, and the U.S. Supreme Court. Stay with us. We'll be. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Earlier this week, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on a closely watched case involving a baker, a gay couple, and a wedding cake, Masterpiece Cake Shop v. Colorado Civil Rights Commission. More than 5 years ago, David Mullins and Charlie Craig asked Jack Phillips, the cake shop owner, to make them a wedding cake, and he refused because he said he did not believe in same-sex marriage because it violated his Christian faith. They brought a complaint to the state Civil Rights Commission, and the case made its way to the Supreme Court, where the arguments involved the First Amendment, public accommodations, and discrimination. The court ruled 7-2 for the baker and said the commission was biased against his religion, leaving a number of unanswered questions. We asked David Cole to join us. He argued for the couple before the Supreme Court and is legal director of the ACLU, also a professor at Georgetown University, wrote a book not so long ago called Engines of Liberty, The Power of Citizen Activists to Make Constitutional Law. David Cole, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Let me begin with what the court actually ruled, because if you look at some of the headlines and even reading some of the stories or reports about what the court decided, it's a bit confused. What did the court actually say?
So the court said that in this case, the Colorado Civil Rights Commission that adjudicated the claim by our clients, the gay couple, against the baker, was infected by religious bias. And they therefore reversed the decision on the ground that the proceeding itself was infected by religious bias. And as a result, they didn't address the question that they took the case to address, the question that the baker asked them to address, which was whether he has a First Amendment right not to serve a wedding cake to a gay couple if he has religious or philosophical objections to same-sex marriage.
Do you know why the court, in a sense, decided not to decide about the baker and the gay couple and the wedding cake?
Well, it's always hard to psychoanalyze the court, but
exactly.
but I think what's important to realize is that the court went out of its way to make clear that if it were to decide that question, it would decide it in the gay couple's favor and against the baker. So it said, and this is from Justice Kennedy's majority opinion for seven justices, it is a general rule that religious and philosophical objections do not allow business owners and other actors in the economy to deny protected persons equal access to goods and services under a neutral and generally applicable public accommodations law. And they cited to a decision from the 1960s in which a restaurant asserted a religious objection to having an integrated restaurant. And in that case, the court described the claim that there's a religious exemption from anti-discrimination laws as patently frivolous. So, you know, I think the court made very clear that it's not going to uphold the rights of businesses to assert a First Amendment right to discriminate. But in this case, because of the peculiarity of the way in which the Civil Rights Commission adjudicated the case, it ruled on the baker's behalf. So, you know, I wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post which said, you know, we lost the battle, but we won the war.
Well, I do want to play a couple of clips from some of your arguments before the Supreme Court, David Cole. But let me just also give out the phone number, which is 1-888-477-9499 to join our conversation. Any questions or comments, you can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I listened to some of the argument yesterday on C-SPAN, including your arguments back and forth. And on the one hand, it's absolutely fascinating. And I do wish these things were live and we could listen and be, you know, our nerdy selves in understanding how the court works. And on the other hand, it was also these torturous arguments about, you know, letters on a cake. Was there anything unusual for you as someone who was arguing before the court? And I'm sure you've done this before.
Yeah. So this was my fifth argument before the court. It's an incredible experience. And it's always torturous.
Is it?
You know, in some sense it is, because the whole point of an oral argument is really for the justices to press the advocates on what would be the implications of the position of ruling for you. You know, how far does this go? What would it mean for the next case? And so they just come up with hypothetical after hypothetical. Mm-hmm. And this was a case, the case involving the, you know, the cake, where everyone, you know, everybody and his mother could come up with all kinds of hypotheticals, which would lead you to sort of have a gut sense in one direction or another. So one that I, you know, came back to a number of times was if the government, the Trump administration, which supported the baker, and the baker were right that there's a First Amendment right not to serve a cake to a customer because you object to celebrating something that customer is doing, then a baker could refuse to sell a happy birthday cake to a black family because he didn't believe that black families should be celebrated.
In fact, we have that clip right there ready to
Sorry,
that's okay. We can hear it from your words. And this is you, actually. We hear just a little bit of Justice Samuel Alito. And this is, we should say, this argument took place in December 2017.
someone can be compelled to write particular words with which that person strongly disagrees. That is your position.
If he has written the same words for others and the only difference is the identity of the customer, yes. So, again, a baker could sincerely believe that saying happy birthday to a black family is different from saying happy birthday to a white family. But we would not say that, therefore, it's permissible for a baker to say birthday cakes for whites only.
Just to give you a chance to elaborate on that, is it because, and this was before Obergefell, right? So this was before the Supreme Court. This all took place before the Supreme Court ruled on gay marriage. Do I have that correct?
That's right. The encounter in Denver, Colorado at the bakery did, yes.
So what's the connection between a gay couple and an interracial couple?
Well, I mean, the point I was making simply is that what public accommodations law requires is that if a business decides to open its doors to the public, it has to serve all customers. It can't start picking and choosing and say, well, we'll sell cakes or books or hammers only to white people or only to straight people or only to males. That's what it requires. It does not require any business to open its doors to the public. There are plenty of writers and performers that don't serve the public generally and can make choices about who they write for and who they perform for and who they create art for. But if you open your doors to the public in America, the rule has been and is in Colorado and in every other state in the union that you have to serve all customers equally. So you don't have to make wedding cakes. But if you're going to make a wedding cake for a straight couple, you can't deny it to a gay couple. If you're going to make a birthday cake for a white family, you can't deny it to a black family.
Now, my understanding was that the cake owner, Phillips, was willing to sell all sorts of cakes to this couple, just not a wedding cake.
Well, there was some dispute about that. But he was willing to serve gay customers for other kinds of products, but he would not sell them a wedding cake. But that's still a violation of the anti-discrimination law. If a restaurant said, we'll serve every appetizer except the oysters to black families, but we're not going to sell the oysters to the black families, you wouldn't conclude, well, that's not discrimination because they'll sell, the asparagus and the fried mozzarella sticks.
Well, let me read. Phillips had an op-ed back in December, and he said, what a cake celebrating this event would communicate was a message that contradicts my deepest religious convictions as an artist. That's just not something I'm able to do, so I politely decline. But this wasn't just a business decision. More than anything else, it was a reflection of my commitment to my faith. My religious convictions on this are grounded in biblical teaching that God designed marriage as a union of one man and one woman. What does then someone like Phillips do about those deeply held religious beliefs?
So we don't doubt the sincerity of Phillips' religious beliefs. Many people had religious beliefs that prohibited interracial marriage in the 1950s and 60s as well, and prohibited interracial dating. And Bob Jones University, for example, which was a university that received federal tax benefits, denied admission not to blacks but to people who believed in or engaged in interracial dating. And the Supreme Court said, no, that's discrimination. And you can have those beliefs. You can advocate against interracial dating, but you can't act on them once you're in the public sphere to harm others, to discriminate against other people. So, yeah, Jack Phillips, if he's opposed to providing wedding cakes to same-sex marriages, then he doesn't need to sell them to the public at large. But once he opens and sells to the public at large, he has to sell the same product to a gay couple that he would sell to a straight couple.
Let me give out that phone number again, and it's 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation, talking with David Cole, National Legal Director for the ACLU, and he represented the couple in the wedding cake Supreme Court decision that was ruled on earlier this week, Masterpiece Cake Shop v. Colorado Civil Rights Commission, also a professor at Georgetown University. David Cole, let me play one more clip. This is you making an argument. This was back in December before the U.S. Supreme Court.
No one is suggesting that the baker has to march in the parade as Mr. Francisco said here. What the Colorado law requires is that you sell a product. When a mom goes into a bakery and says, make me a happy birthday cake for my child, and then she takes that cake home for her 4-year-old son's birthday party, no one thinks that the baker is wishing happy birthday to the 4-year-old.
I thought that was an interesting argument that you made there.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is part of the what's a little bit crazy about the claim here. I've been to many, many weddings. I've seen many wedding cakes, and I have never thought, whoever made this wedding cake for the couple must be personally endorsing this particular marriage, this particular kind of marriage. It's just a product that is sold, which then the couple takes away and uses for its purposes. And so I think it's a strained claim on Mr. Phillips' behalf that somehow he is being compelled to endorse Dave and Charlie's marriage because he has to sell the same product to them that he sells to a straight couple.
But wasn't he and his lawyers making the argument that he was an artist and these were expressive products and, you know, not necessarily, you know, I won't say just a baker, but that he had this protection because he was an artist?
Absolutely. That was their argument. And I think that argument went nowhere. And it's interesting. Only one justice on the court, Justice Thomas, adopts that argument. No other justice on the court adopts that argument. And the reason was made clear during the argument. The lawyers for the baker and the lawyers for the Trump administration could not draw a coherent line to say what would be the expressive businesses that would be protected under their theory. So, for example, they were asked, well, you know, if your baker is engaged in expressive activities and can discriminate, what about an architect? Right. And the lawyer for the baker said, oh, no, architects are not engaged in expressive activity. To which Justice Breyer said, well, Mies van der Rohe is not engaged in expressive activity. And then Justice Kagan said, well, what about a hair salon? And they said, oh, no, that's not expressive. And she said, what about a makeup artist? Oh, no, that's not expressive. To which Justice Kagan said, what do you mean? They've got artist in their name. So the problem with their position is that there's virtually no limit on it. Almost everything we do, from the clothes we wear to the way we style our hair to the way we walk, to is expressive in some nature or another. And so if you created an exemption to anti-discrimination laws for those businesses that are expressive in one way or another, then architects, bakers, restaurants, bookstores could all discriminate on the basis of race, on the basis of sex, on the basis of sexual orientation. It was an argument that really could not be limited. And sort of the most extreme example of this was the Solicitor General arguing for the Trump administration said this wouldn't apply to all cakes, but it applied to Jack Phillips cakes. And the court said, how do you know that? He said, well, you know that because Jack Phillips cakes are highly sculpted and cost a lot of money. Now, I cannot see a First Amendment principle that says that cakes that are highly sculpted get protected by the First Amendment, but not Safeway cakes.
Interesting. A bunch of people want to join us, including, looks like David from Delaware joining us on Radio Times. And David, go ahead. You're on the air. Hi, David. I hear him breathing. You know what I'm going to do, David Cole, is read what he has to say. He says, I was a social worker in New Jersey, a case where a family named their child Adolf Hitler. For his birthday, they went to a ShopRite for a cake, and the store refused. Do the same laws apply there? What do you say?
So the laws don't public accommodations laws do not prohibit businesses from selling particular products or particular messages. What they prohibit is discrimination on the basis of protected statuses like race, religion, sex, sexual orientation, and the like. So a baker could say, look, I'm not going to make a cake that says happy birthday Adolf Hitler for anybody, for anybody. It's the message. It's that message that I refuse, and I won't do it for anybody. That's not discrimination on the basis of any of the protected characteristics. But in our case, our clients, a gay couple, sought precisely the same product that the baker would make for any same-sex couple, I mean, any opposite-sex couple.
So today, could a gay couple go to a baker, ask for a wedding cake, and be refused, be forced to make the cake, or does the court just punted this one?
So as a formal matter, it punted. As a formal matter, it didn't need to decide that question because it concluded that the process that the Colorado Civil Rights Commission engaged in was infected by its own religious bias. So as a formal matter, it's undecided. Hmm. But the law in every state in the union says, no, you cannot discriminate. And the court declined to adopt the argument made by the Trump administration and the argument made by the Baker's lawyers that there is a First Amendment right to discriminate. And the language I quoted to you earlier made it very clear that there is no First Amendment right to discriminate. In fact, Justice Kennedy, at argument and in his opinion, said, you know, the argument that's being advanced by the Trump administration and by the Baker would lead to a world in which businesses that were expressive, however that's defined, could put up signs in their windows saying, we don't make cakes for gay couples, or we don't take photographs of women business owners because we don't believe women should be in business. And he said that would be intolerable to have a society in which businesses could put up signs of that nature in their in their shop windows. So I think the court made it very clear. And indeed, I think, you know, if Charlie and Dave, our clients, were to walk into Masterpiece Cake Shop today and say to Mr. Phillips, we would like a cake to celebrate our anniversary of our wedding, he would have to sell it to them or he'd be violating Colorado's law.
Wow, that's David Cole, our guest on Radio Times today. Again, National Legal Director for the ACLU, talking about a decision by the U.S. Supreme Court earlier this week, Masterpiece Cake Shop v. Colorado Civil Rights Commission. We've got lots more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with David Cole. He's the legal director of the ACLU, and he represented the gay couple who wanted to order a wedding cake, and he joins us to tell us why they, quote, lost the battle but won the war. A little bit later, I'm going to ask him about the president and his ability to pardon, including even pardon himself. In the meantime, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Kate from, looks like, Morristown, New Jersey, to join us on Radio Times. And Kate, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. Does this not involve the principle of the separation of church and state, the state aspect being the requirement of providing a product to all equally and the state supporting this right of citizens to buy the product?
David Cole?
So the law itself doesn't violate the principle of separation of church and state because the law is a neutral law that says nothing about religion. It says, except insofar as it prohibits discrimination on the basis of religion,
right.
But that's been permitted. But the claim here, the religious freedom claim here, was on the other side. It was the baker who claimed that he had a right under the Free Exercise Clause of the Constitution to engage in conduct that the law prohibited for all businesses. He felt that he should have an exemption because he had a Christian-based objection. And the Supreme Court didn't adopt that argument either, and the reason it didn't adopt that argument is that some years ago, about 20 years ago, the court rejected precisely that argument in a case involving California's prohibition on the use of peyote, which was across the board, didn't target any religion, and a Native American group came up and said, well, we use peyote for religious sacramental purposes. You can't apply the law to us. And the court said, no, as long as it's a generally applicable neutral law, it can be applied to the secular and the religious alike, and there's no free exercise problem. So the court did not accept that argument of Mr. Phillips either.
But as the law stands today, could a minister say they will not perform a marriage ceremony because it violates his or her beliefs?
Absolutely. But a minister is not a public accommodation. A public accommodation is limited to businesses that open themselves to the public generally. So, you know, a minister is not a public accommodation. A freelance writer is not a public accommodation. I mean, I'm a freelance writer. I make one-to-one contracts with newspapers and magazines about pieces that I want to write. No one can force me to write what I don't want to write, but that's because I'm not a business open to the public. But if I, for example, opened up a editing service open to the public, I will edit anything. Then I couldn't say I'm not going to edit black people's submissions, or I'm not going to edit gay people's submissions.
How about a Christian baker? And we're talking about a man of what looks like pretty deeply held Christian beliefs saying, I'm not going to make a cake for a bar mitzvah. Can he do that?
Well, it would depend on whether that's identity based discrimination or not. So if if the court concludes that this is discrimination against the customer because of their Jewish identity, then it would be a problem. But if he said, look, I don't make I don't make bar mitzvah cakes, period, then a bar mitzvah cake is different from, any other kind of cake, he can make that decision. So, for example, a Christmas store, right? There's Christmas stores that open up. They don't have to sell Hanukkah goods, but they can't deny a sale of something in their store to a person because he's Jewish.
There's a case that I understand is making its way, and perhaps this is when the court will actually decide on, about this actual sale. Arlene's Flowers v. State of Washington. What do we need to know about that? And then I do want to talk to you about pardons.
Yeah, sure. So Arlene's Flowers, we also represent the gay couple in Arlene's Flowers, and the group that represented the baker in Masterpiece Cake Shop represents the florist in that case. So
it's kind of
a do-over, yeah. And it's actually, up before the court on whether they were going to review it. We might hear on Monday whether they're going to take that up. No one can predict the future, but I suspect that the court, having gone out of its way to avoid deciding the question that the baker wanted the court to decide in this case, I think it's unlikely that they're going to take up Arlene's Flowers. We won Arlene's Flowers below, as we've won every one of these cases in the lower courts below. And so I think my guess is that as long as the lower courts are rejecting these kinds of claims, which they have been pretty uniformly across the country, the Supreme Court will not take up the case until there is a court that goes the other way, and then it will feel the need to resolve the matter. So I doubt they'll take it up, but they could. And if they do, that case would present the question squarely, because there's no evidence whatsoever of religious bias in the proceeding that adjudicated Arlene's Flowers' violation of the public accommodations law.
Just one more question. I was just thinking that there are plenty of bakeries that would be very happy to sell and make money making cakes for gay couples. Do you think commerce, in a sense, could trump whatever laws are on the books?
Well, I think to some extent that's right. I mean, many businesses are, want to serve everybody precisely because that maximizes their profits. And so, to some extent, the commercial marketplace pushes businesses to do the right thing. But, if the marketplace were sufficient, we wouldn't need public accommodations laws. And yet virtually every state in the country and the United States Congress has passed public accommodations laws that prohibit discrimination on various grounds in the operations of businesses. So, this has been a problem. It was a problem with respect to African Americans in the Jim Crow and post-Jim Crow era, and it's been a problem with respect to LGBT folks today.
Let me just read a couple of comments, and I do want to move on to pardons. Email from Gina. If one sells to the public, one sells to the public. If the baker doesn't want to sell wedding cakes to gay couples, he can always choose not to sell wedding cakes, period. An email from Joseph. This is what I like to call a small victory for the religious right. Many will vote with their money on this and not patronize. Eventually, hatred will lose, and the business who discriminate based on all of this will lose as well. Again, I do want to talk about pardons. President Trump pardoned a woman named Alice Johnson. She had been serving a life sentence for what appears to be a nonviolent crime involving federal drug possession and money laundering. She seems like the kind of inmate that deserves a pardon. What do we need to know about the pardon process?
Well, she definitely deserved a pardon, and in fact, the ACLU brought her case to the fore in a report about 3 or 4 years ago, and we've been working with her ever since. For that pardon, we had the assistance, fortunately, of Kim Kardashian,
which you
I
did.
Think is what. Well, yeah, I think that's may have been what got President Trump's attention, and he did in fact give the pardon. The pardon power, look, the pardon power is extraordinarily broad, and it's designed to be extraordinarily broad. It's the power of the president, and governors have it too, to exercise mercy, to say even though you did something wrong, even though you were convicted of a crime. I'm going to exercise my power to absolve you, essentially, of your guilt and to commute your sentence. And it's used quite rarely, but it's very important. President Obama commuted the sentences of many individuals who had been subjected to essentially life sentences for nonviolent drug crimes, and that's perfectly appropriate.
Does it bother you that Kim Kardashian may have done a better job than the ACLU?
Well, I don't think she did a better job. She helped us. We worked alongside Kim Kardashian. So, we're very happy to see that result, and we hope that President Trump will see that it's just to pardon many people who are serving extraordinarily long sentences for nonviolent crimes in this country. Our criminal justice system is out of control and far too draconian, and many, many nonviolent offenders are serving very long prison sentences.
In fact, I heard the president this morning saying there's something like 3,000 cases that are being looked at. Is this process of being pardoned or having the president look at particular cases, is it too convoluted? Does it take too long? And my understanding with Alice Johnson is that it was put before, you probably put it before the Obama administration, yeah. But for whatever reason, they did not commute her sentence.
Yeah. Well, there's an Office of the Pardon Attorney that works on these requests because, of course, many people make such requests, and they look at them, they assess them, they then make recommendations to the president, and then he has the discretion to act or not act on those recommendations. It takes a lot of time because there are so many people who seek this act of mercy, and for the most part, it's handed out fairly, I would say, judiciously. The concern with President Trump is that he will be tempted to use the pardon power for impermissible purposes, that is, to escape responsibility for his own wrongdoing.
Well, let me pick up on that because, as we all know, the president has tweeted, he said he has the absolute right to pardon himself for what appears to be, I don't know, almost any kind of crime. He said, I would not do that because I have done nothing wrong. Does a president have the right to pardon themselves?
So this is an abstract, hypothetical question because, of course, no president has had the chutzpah to try it. President Nixon, interestingly enough, shortly before he left office in disgrace, did ask his Justice Department whether he could pardon himself. And the Justice Department opined that no, he couldn't, that the pardon power is the power to pardon other people, but it is not the power to be the judge in your own case. The principle of the rule of law requires that people not be empowered to engage in self-dealing. So, no, I think there's an extraordinarily strong argument that the president cannot pardon himself, and I think if he sought to do so, the political consequences would be very swift and very profound. I just don't think that this country would accept that kind of self-dealing.
One of his lawyers, Kasowitz, wrote, and this was about a year ago, put simply, the Constitution leaves no question that the president has exclusive authority over the ultimate conduct and disposition of all criminal investigations and over those executive branch officials responsible for conducting those investigations. Of course, this raises questions because of the Mueller investigation into what happened in the 2016 presidential election. What do you make of what Kasowitz said?
So this is an argument that's repeated by many and often by Alan Dershowitz, the Harvard law professor, who seems extraordinarily concerned about President Trump's civil liberties, but not about anybody else's. And the argument is, since the president is the head of the executive branch and is the executive branch that brings prosecutions, the president cannot obstruct justice, cannot be guilty of essentially interfering with a prosecution, because at the end of the day, it's his decision whether a prosecution proceed or not. That is clearly wrong. I mean, if there were evidence that somebody bribed President Trump in order to direct the Attorney General to dismiss a prosecution, that would be a crime. It would clearly be a crime, and it would be a crime of obstruction of justice. So, and we have a whole set of rules and norms that are designed to insulate the prosecutorial process from the president, and in states to insulate the prosecutorial process of DAs and attorney generals from the governor, for precisely this reason. It's the same reason that the president can't pardon himself. In this country, the rule of law means that we are a country of laws, not of men. It means that no one is above the law. And if you give the president the power to stop an investigation because he's concerned that it would demonstrate wrongdoing by him or by his close associates, then you are putting him above the law.
Well, Rudy Giuliani, I'm not sure how much, how many favors he's doing the president these days, but nonetheless, he said Donald Trump could not be would not be indicted even if he shot James Comey. Does that make any sense to you?
That makes no sense whatsoever, and it just illustrates the lengths to which they feel that they have to go in order to defend the president. I mean, if the president had nothing to hide, he wouldn't be talking about pardoning himself. He wouldn't be seeking to get James Comey to stop investigations and prosecutions of his people. He wouldn't have fired James Comey for the Russia thing, as he admitted, both to the Russia ambassador and to Lester Holt on television. So this is how far they have gone. I think it just underscores how afraid they are of what this investigation might reveal.
We have 1 minute. I'm asking you, can the president be subpoenaed? And of course, you know, this is one of the big questions.
Yes, he can. The court has already ruled that in the Nixon White House case. There was a subpoena for the Nixon secret White House tapes, and Nixon objected on executive power grounds, and the Supreme Court said no, he has to turn them over where there's a legitimate criminal investigation.
You teach at Georgetown Law School. Are we in an instructive time in our country's history?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, very instructive time. And I think the real question will be, you know, do we allow the executive branch to make these kinds of claims without accountability? Or do we stand up as citizens to fight for the liberties and values that this country stands for at its best? And I thus far, at least, you know, from the standpoint of the ACLU, have been very encouraged by the willingness of people to stand up and fight for what this country stands for at its best, and not to allow President Trump to override all of those values.
David Cole, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. National Legal Director for the ACLU, also professor at Georgetown University. You can find out all sorts of things about Radio Times. You can find us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. You can check out our Instagram. You can download a podcast. You can also sign up for a newsletter. Many ways to connect with the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.